Mac, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. Don Moeller and I together. I am out of ice cream right now, so we got to get out to Tatarka and make sure we're awakening more than just our taste buds. Made here in Baltimore, one of our great sponsors, Tatarka Ice Cream. I got the peanut butter cup here, but I highly recommend the Honey Graham. We have not been to State Fair out in Catonsville in a number of weeks, certainly not together. We did have a lunch out there during this period of time, but missing the shrimp and grits, missing the chicken and waffles. Get on out to State Fair. At some point, we're going to be able to bring these guests together and be able to do this again. Even down at Lexington Market as well with our partners at Fadley's. You can ship those crab cakes all summer long. We did an incredible segment about where those crab cakes come from and talk about shopping local and buying local and local crabs. All of that up at Baltimore Positive. I had a chance to catch up with Jeff Moeller, part of the Moeller and Gary Realty team. Don Moeller's son, Jeff, a Baltimore Positive visitor, WNST this week. We're going to get that out in the buyatoyota.com audio vault as well. Don, I know we've been trying to grab some guests that we've been trying to get at various points. COVID has gotten in the way, and I know you have a special relationship with our guests for this segment of Baltimore Positive, and certainly if there's anyone that did not need a written excuse as to why they have been tardy here at Baltimore Positive, it's probably been the most active, busy guy in the area, and I'm going to let you do the honors here, Don.
I can't imagine anyone much busier than my good friend, Dr. Mohan Sunta, the CEO of University of Maryland Medical System. And Doc, before we get started, I jokingly said to you, when was the last time you got some sleep? And I said 2 or 3 months, and I think you said maybe more than that, right?
Yeah, yes, sir. It's been quite the challenge, but we are trying to stand up to the challenge and demonstrate the unique resource that our health system is to the state of Maryland.
Well, go ahead, Don. No, it's all yours.
No, you go. Jump in.
Well, in being involved in this, I would think that whatever crisis management skills, and we talk about this at the very front, whatever the pandemic playbook is, and most of us don't quite frankly have a pandemic playbook for ourselves, I would think every hospital in the country has run through some semblance of something to think, what if the worst case scenario were to ever happen? I think this has tested all of that for everyone here in this country.
Yeah, so there's no question that I think every organization, every healthcare organization in the country has an emergency preparedness playbook. But regardless of what's in anybody's playbook, I think the realities of the depths of challenge associated with this crisis and the longevity of the crisis, I think, has brought a unique challenge to literally the world when we think about, dealing with a virus-based pandemic like we're dealing with COVID.
Mohan, in your experience, and you've been at this a long time in the medical field and involved in hospital management, along the way, give us a sense, is there ever any training or anticipation that a virus of this nature, a worldwide pandemic, would hit and we'd have to be prepared for it? Is it something that you just can't prepare for?
Well, so what I would say is I think we at the medical system, based on the size and scale of our entire organization, where we are today delivering 25% of all of the hospital-based healthcare in the state of Maryland, and we have foundational differentiating programs like shock trauma, which is literally an international thought leader in how you deal with critical care, time-sensitive care, trauma. We are the organization that, if there is to be one, that has knowledge and experience associated with a challenge like this. I think we're an organization that would be in better position than most. Our foundational partnership with the School of Medicine at the University of Maryland, which is home to the Institute of Human Virology and the Center for Vaccine Development, these these resources do form a unique combination. And so while I think we have just an incredible cadre of human talent, the reality is, while people have talked about this potential and we've thought about it and there's even been planning for some of this kind of challenge, I don't think anybody could have anticipated the dramatic burden that this has placed on our entire society.
Well, Doctor, I would say for anyone that saw the movie Contagion, right, we saw so much in the early part of this, as to how this would happen, why this would happen, scientists not being listened to by politicians or leaders or business figures. The last 7 or 8 months from the time that maybe it made its way onto your desk, maybe in a little headline in the corner, that there is a coronavirus in China that is a little undetermined. I would think that that probably was in early January that maybe you heard about it or saw a scroll somewhere in your world. What's the first thought that comes into your mind at that point that makes it not what Ebola was or certainly not what HIV, but any of these other types of things that were transmitted during our lifetime to say this was going to be the big one for us?
So I think, you know, when we first started to hear about what was coming out of Wuhan, China, I think probably for many of us, the first indications of the potential scale was how quickly it went from those first messages scrolling across the bottom of a ticker to seeing the images of in China, the way that the Chinese government was trying to respond to building healthcare capacity. You may have seen pictures of cranes literally building hospitals in days. And that was a relatively short period of time. And then from that point to the time we heard about Europe and the time we heard about it hitting the West Coast, that speed, what we call flash to bang speed, was so dramatically short that that was our really go signal to say there's got to be a dramatic amount of planning and focus associated with this. And so we're fortunate, again, at the medical system, that we also had opportunity to partner with our government leaders. The governor in the state of Maryland, the legislature. As the governor rolled out the plans, we were fortunate to have a seat at the table in those conversations. And I think Maryland as a state has really distinguished itself from the very beginning of this pandemic with how we've responded, some of the decisions we've made, that I think the data has shown, right, that we have positioned our communities better as a consequence of proactive management of the challenge as opposed to simply reactive.
So much of this is good citizenry, right? Like the citizens are the ones that make this good or bad by and large.
Absolutely. So, you know, my saying is, you know, do we believe in the notion that we are each other's brothers and sisters keepers? Does what I do as a private citizen impact you? And are you willing to take on the responsibility of your behavior impacting me? And I think that's really a significant piece of how we're going to respond as a nation or not respond between now and the time we get to vaccine development.
Well, Doc, we're not going to have you on here, obviously, and not take this opportunity to again remind all of our listeners, whether they're in their car, whether they're sitting at home listening on their phone, I want you, if you would, just from a medical point of view, because we're not doing politics in this segment with you, we're doing medicine. From a medical point of view, tell people why wearing a mask can be a life-saving decision.
Yeah, absolutely. So it is just pure objective data that tells us that if you put a mask on, your risk of spreading the virus is dramatically reduced. And so you're wearing a mask because you care about others. They're wearing a mask because they care about you. And again, remove all the politics if you possibly can. And this is actually just straightforward science. If you can decrease the spread of disease, and the reason that it's so important in this virus is foundationally connected to the fact that because there is such a high percentage of asymptomatic transmission, meaning you don't know you have the virus. And so the mask, sometimes people make the mistake of thinking, well, I don't have symptoms, so I don't have to wear a mask. But the data that would say anywhere from 25 to 40% of people who are carrying the active virus don't know it, that's why it's so important to wear a mask whenever you're in public. If you're somewhere where you're indoors, if you're somewhere where you can't socially distance by 6 feet or more, we actually, I believe, have a responsibility to each other to put a mask on. And in fact, the data tells us you can decrease the risk of spread that way.
Well, and then you tie that in, it seems to me, and again, for those listening, just tuning in, we are with CEO of University of Maryland Medical System, Dr. Mohan Sintha, talking all things COVID. Truly one of the experts, certainly in the Mid-Atlantic states, but really in the nation. And we're delighted that he's taken time out of his busy schedule to join us. So, Doc, you've talked about masks. Now, let's go to the next controversial item, which is this whole issue of testing. And, there have been all kinds of examples the past few days. But for some to suggest that if we just tested less, we'd have fewer cases. I think those of us who are trying to make 1 + 1 = 2, and again, maybe you can help us make 1 + 1 = 2, whether I test or not, people still have the virus, right? I mean, just when I don't test, it doesn't mean the virus goes away.
No, absolutely. So you're right. The value of testing is based on what do you do with the information. And if you know to test somebody and you know they're positive, then you can help quarantine them and help them inadvertently spreading the disease. If you don't test and you don't know and you only wait for somebody to get sick enough to say, I better go to the doctor or I better go to the hospital, then what you're going to see is dramatic increases of the spread of the disease in the community. And so that notion, and when you look around the world, again, this is not really a controversial concept. When you look at the nations who have done best at helping reduce the number of active patients with disease, testing and tracing, those two combinations. So once I know if you're positive, I know where you've been, I can trace where you've been, I can identify people who you've been exposed to, who you've been exposed to, and then I can test them. That's how, and then I can isolate them. That's how you actually stop the spread of disease. So testing and tracing are two intimate factors that around the world, when you look at other nations who have successfully brought down the incidence of active disease, they've done it with testing and tracing being a fundamental approach.
Do we have any hope for people who don't believe in the science part of this to keep this message going and seeing these really bad outcomes right now in Florida and Texas in the South, where amidst the hot weather, we believe this myth that perhaps the hot weather would change things? Getting people to believe the scientific part, I can only imagine at your level across the scope of tens of thousands of employees who are all very affected by this in so many ways. My wife's a two-time leukemia survivor. You know, we wore a mask everywhere for the better part of 3 years, everywhere we went to keep her alive. She was neutropenic at various points. So we learned it that way, but I wouldn't have known that without leukemia. But in our lives as adults, we wouldn't have thought about contagiousness other than beyond doorknobs and getting the flu in the winter. for America by and large, in large scopes, to not buy into the science of this. It's Don and I talk about it every week. I can only imagine at your level and the way you've studied that it is a little jaw-dropping to some degree.
It is challenging, and I will tell you that the piece that is, quite honestly, the most challenging, and that is, you know, we are a workforce of 28,000, just north of 28,000 employees across our health system. And when you think about the term essential employees, these are the folks who run towards the problem instead of away from it. These are the folks who have answered the call. And I have to tell you, it is so demoralizing to our workforce and across the healthcare industry. Forget the medical system. Just take the healthcare industry in this country. For men and women to be put in, to risking their own health for the health of communities, to see that there is something that we could be doing to help decrease the risk of the disease spread and we're choosing not to do it is incredibly, incredibly demoralizing. And so, you know, again, I think some of the ways we have to continue to communicate with each other is trying to, and you said it earlier, if we could remove the politics from it and recognize that this is, for everything that we've been through as a nation, when you think about the very purposeful approach that we took, as hard as it was, to shut down our economy as a way of helping flatten the curve, and we were successful doing that in this country. To me, the conversation really ought to be, going forward, we have the opportunity to maintain our economy, to actually help it regrow while we are also managing through this pandemic. And so we can have both control of a virus spread and return of economy if we choose to be active participants in the solution. If we choose to ignore it, or say we're just tired of it, or, oh, it's summertime and we want to be at the beach and all those other things that people want to do, all we're, I guess what healthcare communities are saying is, but there's a reasonable middle ground that allows us to consider having both healthy communities and a reasonable economy while we are navigating a once in a multiple generation pandemic. And it seems silly that we wouldn't do everything we can to try and have both.
Hey, sometimes the simplest words are the best. Dr. Mohan Sunatha, who says it seems silly to not do everything that we could. Doc, I wonder if you could, so many things to talk about. I wonder if you peel the curtain back a little bit for us, because certainly Nestor and I have talked about it on and off the air. My heart just aches for these doctors and nurses and respiratory therapists and x-ray technicians and food, the cafeteria workers, everybody, all of those 28,000 that you wake up thinking about every day, and how physically exhausting and the mental toll that this is taking on them. Can you give us some insight into how they're doing and what your perspective is on their mental health at this point?
Sure. So we describe our workforce as the single greatest asset within the medical system. And from the very beginnings of this pandemic, we made very purposeful decisions as leaders of our health system to lean into and support our workforce. We recognized the financial challenges associated with the crisis are dramatic. And yet, you know, how we decide to act as a health system, how we decide to support our workforce now is going to determine our long-term success as an organization and the culture that we want. Our healthcare providers, our entire workforce, I said, they're the folks who are running towards the problem. And one of the things that I've been amazed at is the resiliency of this workforce in terms of their willingness to do day in and day out, to go the extra mile for each other, for our communities, for the patients, to make sure that we're doing everything we can to help our communities get through this unprecedented challenge. One of the things that we as health system administrators are, you know, what we are doing is trying to be tireless in providing the resources necessary. So you've heard a lot about personal protective equipment and how we are functioning as a system, but we're also partnering with systems like Hopkins and other health systems around the state to say no one organization is going to solve this problem by ourselves. And so where we can support each other and our workforces, we're trying to do it. But, you know, the word I use about our workforce is inspiring. And, you know, I'm somebody who has spent nearly 30 years in this organization. And so I'm admittedly very biased when it comes to my view of the talents and skill sets of this workforce. But what I'm seeing, you know, since mid-January till now is even jaw-dropping. It's jaw-dropping even for me.
It's heroic. It's nothing short of heroic. And I think we are all in awe of it and just trying to imagine what it feels like. And that's why I feel, I hear in your voice a real sense of frustration in areas, because I think we agree with you that Maryland, and again, kudos to the governor. We've been very supportive of the governor and complimentary of his efforts from the beginning. But when you see these other states, and where I'm going with this question is, I guess, is how we get out of this, Dr. Sunta, in the sense that when I see Florida now just raging out of control, when they were in denial for so long.
And opening Disney World, by the way. So,
opening Disney.
Right. Which means they're still in denial, right? Like, literally, right?
Right. Texas out of control and Arizona out of control. Once the genie, and this, again, is a medical question, not a political one. Once the genie is out of the bottle, like it is in those states, what options do they have to get the genie back in the bottle?
Well, so I think, like, immediately step one is doing some of the common sense things that we talked about. The, you know, the idea of enforcing things like masks. Now they are at a point, quite honestly, where they have some very hard decisions to make about their economy. But it would seem to me that, you know, the idea of opening Disney World and some of the other decisions that they are making have more to do with the politics than it does with the science of COVID spread. Because the science is sort of irrefutable in terms of what needs to be done. Yes, we need to be practicing social distancing. Yes, we need to put masks on. Yes, we need to wash our hands. Yes, we need to stop gathering in large numbers in places simply for social convenience or social outlets. Those are simple things you can do that can help decrease the spread. And I think the places that are experiencing these hotspots, they're just on the leading edge, again, of lessons that we ought to all be learning. I think back to February, March, as we in the state of Maryland were preparing, we had the benefit of learning from Seattle and from New York and from Italy, and seeing what was going on there to help inform some of the decisions that we were making. And the good news is I think we in many other states learned those lessons well, and we did flatten the curve. I'm hoping that, again, leaders in those other states kind of take up that same mantle and say, okay, whatever decisions we made that have led to where we are today, what are we going to do different? Because if we don't do something different, we know what's coming, right? We know what the fall is going to look like. We know when the flu and COVID combine, the risk to the health systems being overloaded and therefore the outcomes of patients deteriorating, we know it. It's not like we can plead ignorance at this point. We absolutely know it.
So we know what's coming down the road, obviously. Particularly moms and dads who are listening, everyone is trying to figure out this school thing. And again, just from a purely medical point of view, Can you envision, at least in the first half of the year, schools and schoolhouses that look the way they did pre-COVID? Is that even a realistic goal for the fall?
Yeah, so I think it is a real challenge to imagine, again, in any, whether we're talking schools, whether we're talking businesses, whether you're talking any area where large groups of people, whether they be children or adults, are congregating, if we think we're going to be able to just do what we have done historically, in the face of COVID's active spread, and it to believe that we can do that and it won't have a detrimental effect in terms of the spread of disease is a bit naive. I understand there are lots of considerations in all of those calculations, and there are consequences to the issues of education and child care and the impact of children and access to technology to allow them to continue education. I'm not suggesting it's simple. But I am suggesting that something other than the same old approach is going to be needed in order to both, again, address the issues that are in front of us and protect our communities.
I think, Doctor, I think we were all concerned about some sort of, you know, overload for the system here months ago. The insight that you have, and I think it's very unusual, and you can speak to this, and that you've never been anywhere else, right? Like, that you know right. Your organization so well. As you well know, I come from the sports side, and I've seen you around town, and I've admired you. And Don ran Baltimore County and has always admired the way the Ravens run. And we talk about sports and an organization and knowing the parts and the part. And you don't change doctors every week. You don't change nurses every week. You don't change leadership every week. We don't change quarterbacks every week, right? There's part of that for you during this that maybe makes it easier on you and your organization and makes your organization better than if you had taken over, you know, some organization in Texas 6 months ago that you didn't know.
Yeah, I think what you're speaking to, and we always use the Ravens as a phenomenal example, which is culture. What is the impact of culture? And culture, you see the value of culture in any organization, most notably at times of stress, right? It's easy to describe your culture when everything's sunshine and rainbows. Your culture gets defined, to me, at times of stress. And you've seen it with the Ravens. You see it with other sports, with the Orioles. You see it in our communities. With how organizations respond to stress. And I think you're right. I get the benefit of knowing our organization intimately. But I will tell you I've been in this role for 6 months, and even though I've grown up in this organization, I've been amazed at the strength of the culture of this organization, given the geographic scale that we have across the state of Maryland.
Well, as someone whose dad got his medical degree from the University of Maryland, and someone whose mother got her nursing degree from the University of Maryland, I'm very, very proud of what you all have done. Doc, well, not holding you to it, but what's reasonable looking forward? I mean, I hear these crazy time estimates for vaccines. And the question, I like to pose the question this way. A vaccine for me means that people will be able to go to their senior center or to their general practitioner and get a shot for this virus that will be at least as effective as the annual flu shot is. And we know it's not always 100% effective, but in some kind of time frame, are we talking 18 months, 2 years? When would that kind of normalcy, when I can go to CVS and get my shot for COVID, when might we expect that in the medical world?
So right now, again, and we have the benefit, thanks to the Center for Vaccine Development that is part of the University of Maryland, Baltimore, University of Maryland School of Medicine, these folks are literally on the front lines of the international vaccine development trials that are going on in this country. And it is encouraging. If there's encouraging news, it is amazing what has happened to the international science community around collaboration around vaccine development. And whether you listen to Dr. Fauci or Dr. Redfield on a national scale, whether we listen to Kathy Neuzel, who runs the Center for Vaccine Development here at Maryland, they are all cautiously optimistic that we will get through probably into the early winter with the idea that we will identify a candidate vaccine for mass production. The unusual response of the biotech industry in this crisis compared to any other previous history in vaccine development is they've actually already scaled ready for mass production for the vaccine when it gets identified. And so it is not unreasonable to think that 12 to 18 month timeline, given what has gone on and right now the science as we understand it. Now, there's a long way to go from, you know, the middle of July till the late fall to have the data finalized and say, yep, we've identified the vaccine candidate, now go mass produce it and start distributing it to the CVSs and to senior centers and to the hospitals, all the places and doctor's offices where we do vaccine delivery. But the truth is, if we were to achieve that, just frame of reference, in our nation's history, the fastest we ever got to vaccine development before COVID-19, I believe, was polio, which was 4 years. And
yeah, see,
that, right? So, again, I think we have to be realistic, right? So if we end up 2 years from the time we heard about COVID to the time we feel like, okay, we've now demonstrated immunity as a society, that would be a pretty dramatic change from what we've accomplished historically in medicine.
So the message to folks really is, if you're thinking that sometime around Thanksgiving or Christmas or New Year's Day, we're going to be beyond this, that's just not a realistic...
It's really unlikely. It's really unlikely that it would be that short. And I actually, what I would say is a little differently, Don, which is I think we have to buckle up and recognize that, again, whether the projections, all models are inherently wrong in some way, but directionally, all the models are going to tell us that this is going to be a challenging fall for this nation. And it's going to be a challenging fall and into the winter as a consequence of when you combine a resurgence of COVID and a flu. Now, we don't ever know any given year what the flu season is going to look like exactly, but we know it's going to complicate the picture this year because of COVID. And we have to be prepared for that. And what we do now, wearing masks, social distancing, washing our hands, being smart in our behaviors, can actually influence what the fall looks like.
And I say to folks, Nestor, we've said it over and over again. In this particular episode of Baltimore Positive, this is a politics-free zone. This is the doctor. This is the CEO, the head of the University of Maryland Medical System. Believe it or not, more qualified than a former game show host like Chuck Woolery to be telling us what we ought to be doing to combat this virus.
Doc, I want to give one last thing. Just on the epidemiology of this and your background in medicine and where you are, can you speak to, I mean, you're a very decorated guy, but if Dr. Anthony Fauci were giving a speech at Georgetown or somewhere in the area 5 years ago, 10 years, you know, when you were trying to become the president, CEO, you know, to speak to his education and this would be like me speaking to the legend of what has Tom Brady ever done on a football field? Well, let me tell you. You know what I mean? You'd have to explain it, right? The cheating, too, by the way. But in the case of Fauci, I find it just unconscionable what's happened this week, and I don't want to speak to that or to speak to the politics of the stench that's coming out of D.C. at this point, but just to the qualifications and the credibility and the literal world-class expertise, the Tom Brady, Bill Belichick type of expertise that Anthony Fauci brings to the table for on behalf of our government, but on behalf of our people, right?
There's no question. Dr. Fauci's credentials are unassailable. And we as a nation and the world are fortunate that a man who is as decorated and as accomplished in his career, who could be off focusing on other things in his life, has chosen to remain as committed to this mission as he has been, is a huge asset in our dealing with this pandemic. And that's an objective assessment. That is not viewed through any political lens. We are very fortunate to
well,
have Dr.
You know, I appreciate that,
team.
Doc, and you've been very generous with your time. But before you go, Nestor, I don't know if you know this, but a few years ago when Dr. Suntha was sitting around, and I guess he just didn't have enough on his plate, he decided that, you know, why don't I just go to Wharton School of Business at the University of Penn and get an MBA to go along with my medical degree. So, Mohan, educate our listeners. What motivated you to, I mean, that's not something that every high-powered medical person strives to do. What made you want to go to the University of Penn and get
was it the love of Philadelphia, right?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Philly, I will say that.
Oh, but, you were? So you're an Eagles fan then, huh? No?
No, I'm a Ravens fan.
I'm just checking.
Easy there.
Just checking.
I came to Baltimore, and I was waiting for the Ravens to get here when they got here.
What motivated you to go get an MBA?
For my own professional circumstance was such that as I grew my career in academic medicine as a cancer physician, our health system and our school of medicine thought it would be wise to have a physician leadership voice on the health system side who understood academic medicine as a practicing physician. As I started to do more health system administrative work, system leadership and our board of directors thought it would benefit the system for me to also get a business education. And I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to do that, to do those studies at Wharton. And it was a phenomenal educational experience for me. I'm very blessed to have the opportunity.
Remarkable story. Hey, Nestor, how'd we do on the Baltimore Positive Smart Meter this afternoon?
Well, you know, we've stepped up our game here. Intelligent and wise conversations. You want wisdom, you got to find wise people. President and CEO Dr. Mohan Suntha joining us here. And you know, you went to Philly, but you came home. I mean, you had good cheesesteaks and pretzels while you were there. I mean, I go to Philly, I always come back here, though, the way you did. So,
no question.
Well, listen, you know, from the cancer side of things, and you know, my wife's a 2-time leukemia survivor, just to see the medicine, and it never been a part of my life. You know, my wife was diagnosed in March of 14, and people like you that have been on the front of this, you talk about heroes. I mean, I talk about sports my whole life. I started watching these doctors and nurses come to my wife's bedside to keep her alive through 2 transplants from a very magnanimous donor in Germany who's kept her alive. So for people like you that have kept a myriad of people alive, like my wife, we honor you, and we really appreciate the work you're doing. And it took us a long time to get you on, and I'm glad that we had some time together here to at least learn and hopefully make an impact with our audience and our community, because we might not even be at the 50-yard line of this thing, right? We got a long way to go.
We got a ways to go, right? We're running this marathon. It's not a sprint, but we'll get through it. And thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak to you all today. And I think we as folks who own the privilege of being anchor institutions in the city of Baltimore and being disproportionate voices in the state of Maryland, we are incredibly fortunate to be able to serve the citizens of Baltimore and the state of Maryland. And thank you for what you all are doing in terms of getting the message out and educating folks, because at the end of the day, education is power in this fight.
Well, we've certainly seen
that
over the last 6 months.
Nothing more positive, nothing more Baltimore positive than the University of Maryland medical system. Dr. Suntha, thank you so much. Please stay safe and take care of yourself. You've got to get
all right.
Get some exercise, wash the hands, wear a mask. We're all doing it. Don Moeller's doing it over in Catonsville at State Fair. We get down to Fadley's. We're going to bring everything back together and make this thing app. We're all going to eat ice cream from Taharka to celebrate. We also had a great conversation with Jeff Moeller from Moeller & Gary Realty. I tell you, all of our sponsors involved here in pulling this thing together as we merge WNST and Baltimore Positive this summer with great, great guests. On behalf of President and CEO Dr. Mohan Suntha from the University of Maryland Medical System and former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller, my partner in crime here at WNST.net. We are AM 1570 Taos in Baltimore. We're calm. Nothing more local than that conversation, and always Baltimore Positive.